We get the hour going by welcoming in our friend Colin Fleming. Now, for some writers, having three books right there on the verge, getting ready to go, well, that would be a career. For Colin, we call that last week. Welcome in, Colin.
Kimball with the big lead in. Wow, you're bringing it today, man.
Do what I can. It's Tuesday. I gotta be on the top of my game.
Do you have some coffee before I come on? Get pumped up, maybe go into the back room, the break room, play a little Eye of the Tiger, get ready to go.
What I need to know is this. I enjoyed the picture that you posted on the socials of that that glorious mane of yours. Tell me it's still intact.
It is, but as my sister said to me today, she said, it must be awfully hot with that, and it is very hot at that. But then I got angry at myself for being weak because women have as much hair as I do. They have more hair, right?
Yes.
So they don't complain about it like, oh, my head is too hot. I need to get it all cut away. So I don't want to be like that. I want to be strong like those women with their heads of hair.
I think you can do it. Just tuck it all in under that Bruins hat and you're good to go.
I have to sleep in a beanie so I don't suffocate by inhaling my own hair. So it's... I was thinking, too, like, if I ever committed a crime here, not like I really want this on the evidentiary record, but there is so much DNA in this dye of an apartment that the only way I could be cleared is if the building burned down. That's the only way you could get rid of all the DNA, even just the hair component of the DNA.
Well, all right. If there's a fire, I'm sure they'll subpoena the tape of today's show, but we'll deal with that when the time comes. Let's talk about these three books. Now, we're talking about your Sam Cooke book. Not a Sam Cooke book, a book about Sam Cooke.
It just runs together, right?
Your Scrooge book, and then a collection called Brackets.
Yes, that's the truncated, easy-to-go-with name that I've just started calling the book, because the actual name, it's pretty cool. The main title is If You, and then the actual Brackets symbol, because it's very open-ended, really, how life is, and in some ways, our choices in life, and even when it's not as open-ended maybe as we wish it to be, it appears that way, or appears that we have some control, and the subtitle is Fantasy, Fabula, Bleepery, word you can't say on the radio, and Hope. So, a bunch of F words, and then what I think, and what we've talked about as the most important commodity in all of this world, more important than love, more important than friendship, more important than anything really, is hope. So that is in there too with all these other things. So as I've been doing all that I've been doing, the nonfiction and the blog and the op-eds and the arts pieces and the sports pieces and coming on here and wherever else, and of course writing an awful lot of short fiction and having a novel come out, I was doing these three books simultaneously. So that's what my weeks look like, where I'm writing and sometimes an actual book in a week, and then I'm knocking out three short stories. And today I revised one from fall 2018 and dashed off a 1,500-word piece on Charlie Christian and this unreleased tape that he had made at Minton's in New York in 1941. But yeah, it's doing the three books at once and three totally different kinds of books. I don't even really know what you can compare that to. And it's not me just being some arrogant jackass. It's because there's nothing you can compare it to.
Let me ask you this. And we've talked about your writing process and how often on a walk you'll compose a story in its entirety, sometimes even a book. I know with great songwriters, McCartney has talked about this, songs coming to him in his sleep. Do book ideas, do story ideas come to you in those few hours that you doze?
I wouldn't say that it's like that. I'd say that I consciously write them while I'm asleep. Like, it's disturbing. And I can point out some that you've read, for instance, that were written that way. Transitionings, you've read that one. Mm. That was written entirely while I was asleep, because I have a conscious control now while I am not conscious, which sounds weird. And I was thinking today, too, about like all the stories I hold in my head at once, all the different things, the ideas, whatever. If you go through like the correspondence of somebody who was pretty productive, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, you'll see that he's working on a story and maybe a novel, and he's working on a story in order to fund the time to write in the novel, and he might be fielding requests from an editor to revise another story. You'll note in the blog, you've seen this, you've seen the blog over enough years, that I actually lay out the things that are later going to be in your inbox, where you go, oh my goodness, I can't believe he wrote that. But if you go back, you'll see it was one of 20 things mentioned in the blog. And I've never seen anything like that, where someone has, it's a huge amount of fiction alone in my head at once. And I was thinking the other day when I did a new workout, I went out to the Blue Hills and I went up and down it a bunch of times. And the third time, I took a different route down. So I was at the bottom of the ski slope there. And I turned around and I looked at the ski slope and I just thought to myself, oh, you MF-er. Because there was no way I could not then try to run up it. And I was thinking last night too, that's like, it's brutal being me in a lot of ways right now with what I'm going through with this industry and everything. But it's also brutal in a sense because I literally never have a second where I'm not working on a story or a book. Like, if I put in a huge amount of work in a day, and you saw that Instagram post, which was my morning yesterday, anybody wants to check that out there, it's all accessible. I'm in bed last night, and it's like, you have 97 stories in your head. Why do you need to have 98 right now? And I can't stop myself from coming up with this new amazing thing that I can just keep there. I can't ever. Can you imagine what it'd be like trying to compete against me? My God, I'm beating all these people. I have an industry against me when I don't. Can you even imagine, like, if you were envious and you wanted to have a go, and it's like, I can beat that guy. Can you imagine how much that would just suck for somebody?
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Last week, Johnny Crawford passed away, and you and I both weighed in on social media with our thoughts. But you've spoken about The Rifleman a number of times before on the show, and what a, I think, underappreciated television classic this is, and largely because of that relationship between father and son.
Yeah, that's the bulk of it. And I like Westerns in general. I can watch almost any TV Western when it comes on, and you know that some of them just, they haven't aged that well. And, like, for instance, I grew up loving Bonanza. And it was in reruns, obviously, by that time. But, like, I was really into Bonanza. But Bonanza, it doesn't hold up that well now. It holds up as something like you enjoy, or holds up as nostalgia, but it doesn't hold up as kind of cutting edge in the way that art can. And art entertainment, we shouldn't make the mistake of being like it's one or the other, because the best art to me is also entertainment. It walks that blended line. That's really what the goal ought to be. So The Rifleman is a show that I think probably if I was younger, I wouldn't have liked it as much. And it wasn't a show that I watched until I was an adult. And coming into it as an adult, I was able to pick up on these adult themes and these levels. And then, of course, you have these huge talents that are shooting The Rifleman or directing The Rifleman, who did some, like, classic B-noir masterpiece from 1944. So you get that kind of thing. But really, what makes The Rifleman, the gun is cool, and I don't know why people call out Lucas McCain. That's never going to work out favorably for you, speaking of competition. It's that father-son relationship. It's not just a father-son relationship, because it's more than that. It's a father-son friendship in the sense that Lucas, the Rifleman himself, people don't know the show, possesses sufficient Socratic wisdom that he can learn from the boy. I bet you're like that. Bit of a Rifleman in you, I would imagine, in your family setup and with your students and whatnot. That's how Lucas McCain is. He's very hard in some ways. He's very firm in his beliefs and his moral convictions, but he's also a person of great fluidity with those he respects. And I find the dynamic of the relationship to be one that is what makes the series endure.
And even the title, The Rifleman, it seems in most episodes, using that rifle is about the last thing Lucas McCain wants to do.
It is, but I saw a count once that he kills like 807 people on the show or something like that. This is my grim bastard out there. It's like, yep, that's technically a kill. And like writes it down in like a notebook for his MeTV blog. And it is not what he wants to go to, certainly. And he's a man of faith, but even for the kind of biblical allusions you sometimes get, it's a secular faith. It's not like a crazy Bible-thumping sort of faith. It's a very humanistic faith, I would say, that he has. I think Lucas McCain would be one of those people who would have a belief in something larger than himself, but wouldn't at the same time take gospel as literal gospel, who would allow for story and symbolism. But the episodes where certainly he does have to use the rifle, but then there are just other ones where it doesn't, he does, but it's almost like beside the point. Like, it's part of the plot, but oftentimes with the best art, you're not, I don't want to undersell plot, but you might not be there primarily for the plot. You're there. I'd even say that's how it is with the first Star Wars film. Today is this anniversary of its premiere and all that from 1977. You know what the plot is. The reason you're there, we've talked about this, is because you're eavesdropping on these relationships that feel like a part of your own life. And that's what you get with the Sherlock Holmes stories. That's what you get with The Rifleman. That's what you get with, I think, with what I do in terms of fiction. That's why you can keep coming back to these things. So that's really what makes the show what it is.
All right, from former Major League Baseball and NBA player Chuck Connors to Roger Clemens and the twilight of his career, or perhaps not.
That was the famous line from Dan Duquette, right? That he'd come to sort of the back nine. And it goes to show you how differently we look at numbers now than we looked at then. Although I wanted to talk about this today because I've also never really heard anyone make these points that I'm about to make. Because I think what happened with Clemens was he went on to such success with Toronto in the back-to-back Cy Young Awards in 97 and 98 that the narrative became that's when he started using steroids. But if you look at his last 4 years in Boston, when supposedly he was rubbish, now he was bad in 1993. That was an honest-to-goodness bad year. Pitchers have bad years. We have to remember, because it's sort of a silent, great Roger Clemens year. You don't think of it as a great Roger Clemens year, but he led all of baseball, or at least the American League, but I think it might have been all of baseball in WAR in 1992. So he's not good in 93. 94, this guy's dominant. He has a 2.85 ERA. He's second in the American League. He's fifth in the American League in WAR, but his win total is not this gaudy number. So he was being evaluated like, is this kind of DeGrom in reverse? He was being evaluated solely on his win-loss. Now, he's, like, fairly mediocre-ish in 95, but in 96, he's right back there, fifth in WAR. He's one of the best pitchers in baseball over that time period. And you never hear Roger Clemens discussed this way at the end of his Red Sox career. You hear the 500 record. I think he was 500, right? He was, like, 39-39.
Yeah, and in that last year, that 96 season, yeah, he was only 10-13, but he led the league in strikeouts, 257 strikeouts in 242 innings.
Now, I think strikeouts are just like, why even keep strikeouts? They're just a ridiculous stat to me. They're outs. Why not keep ground balls to the second baseman? It's the same thing, except you'd rather have the ground ball with less pitches to the second baseman than the strikeout after 11 pitches. So I've never understood that. But the thing that gets the notoriety from that final year, of course, is the second 20-strikeout game. And, yes, the record looks ugly. And do you have it in front of you? What was his ERA, like 3.63?
3.63, so, but he had 34 starts that year.
So he's having some. And that's also when we're getting into the age of you can have 37 home runs and you're not placing in the top 10. That's when numbers are starting to become crazy. They're like Dante Bichette. All these guys are having these years that just seem completely out of character with who you know them to be rationally as a ball player. But we'd look at that year right now, and you'd place fourth in Cy Young. If you were whatever he was top 10 in ERA, and again, the war is what everybody likes, and you're getting the huge amount of innings, and people do like strikeouts, even though I don't care for them. So you really have, like, one awesome year within those four. A bad year, a mediocre year, and like an upper echelon, like B plus, A minus compared to his peers kind of year. So he's not like this guy you really should be moving on from. And he's not like this person who did this complete about face of going from, as they say right now, washed to stellar. Because the next year in Toronto, he has some just insane war, right? It's like whatever it is. It's like 11.5 or 12.1. It's one of the all-time war seasons that you have to go back to people like Cap Anson to see that kind of like dominance with war. But it's just amazing that no one said that at the time, that like this guy is still pretty good, and no one has said it really since.
And he would win, and this, I was just adding this up, this is remarkable to me. After he left the Red Sox, he would win another 162 games.
He wins more Cy Youngs after he leaves the Red Sox than he does with the Red Sox. That's like just another one of those. Now, he got robbed out of the Cy Young in 1990. That's the year, because wins were the thing. Now, right. We've talked about wins, and I like wins. I don't believe the pitchers don't have any control over wins, because it's all about the offense, because there is still a human component in the psychology to the game, that you are pitching against somebody, and you are pitching to a score. You are aware of the score. You're not pitching in a vacuum. And sometimes you can throw the ball down the middle of the plate, get people out, take your chances, give up four runs, get the team out of there, get into the second game of the doubleheader, if that's what you have on the slate that day. And that's efficacious pitching. So I think you have to factor that in too. But in 1990, that's the year Bob Welch, you know, 27
games.
Now,
his
ERA is, again, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure his ERA was more than a full run higher than Clemens' ERA. But 27 was like, that's kind of close to Denny McClain in 30 victories. So he wasn't even, Welch that year was probably the third best pitcher on his own team. But that was one of those years, to me, it's almost like Wayne Gretzky in 1990-91. He has 163 points, and Brett Hull, because he scores his 80-odd goals, even though he's nowhere near Gretzky in points, and there was that voter fatigue, he gets the Hart Trophy rather than Gretzky. So I think there was also voter fatigue with Clemens and the Cy Young Award. But when you look at his career, he's basically the same thing the entire way through. You don't see that. We talked about Tom Seaver, and Tom Seaver has like no down years until he's something like 17 years in his career. Clemens didn't do that, but he's like in the conversation, top three, top four for best pitcher of all time.
Oh, I agree completely. And you look at some of those, oh my gosh, we know what he did with Toronto, but then he goes to New York. 2001 at 38 years old, he's 20-3 and rolls up 220 innings. In 2004, 41 years old with Houston, 18-4 with a sub-3 earned run average. And then he comes back the next year at 42, wins 13, and has a 1.87 earned run average.
It's kind of sad to me what has happened to the starting pitcher. And this isn't like some, oh, I'm on my lawn yelling into clouds type of thing. What I liked about the starting pitcher was he was somewhat of a Homeric figure. It was his game, that expression, this is my game. You watched him as you would someone in, like, the Iliad. It was his deal. He was the main controller, yay or nay, good or bad, favorable, unfavorable, for anything that was going to happen. He was the one. He was the captain calling the shots that day on the frigate. And he was out there alone. He was in the middle of everything. He had the ball in every single play that he was on the field for. And you took this journey with the starting pitcher. It was more than just sport. Now, starting pitcher is a relief pitcher who just happens to go first. And I don't mean like the opener, but it's like shocking when Eduardo Rodriguez, like a couple starts ago, whatever it was, he pitched into the seventh inning. It's like shocking. And it's just, you're denied this quest quality of this most important, because it's like I mentioned to you in that op-ed that I had tried to do, where the most important positions in sports for a long time have been, in the orders have changed, the quarterback in football, the starting pitcher in baseball and the goalie in hockey. And the goalie in hockey, he's not the most. Now, you can win with like a sort of B-level goalie at this point in the NHL because of defensive systems and the size of the goalie and the equipment and the way the teams play and the lack of high-quality opportunities. So get rid of that. The starting pitcher, he's becoming obsolete. So you have the NFL quarterback and then the 1A stud defenseman in the playoffs in hockey who's in there for half the game and controls play. He's good enough in three zones and on the power play and the penalty kill. But it's sad to lose that sort of Homeric would-be hero or anti-hero, perhaps, in Clemens' case, of the starting pitcher.
And Clemens sort of bridged that era in his years in Boston, 13 seasons. He racked up 100 complete games. And then in his last 9 years in the league, just 4 complete games because people stopped doing that.
They did, and they stopped doing it because the game stopped thinking that was the best course, which is different, I think, than people weren't able to do it. And again, it's a math thing, and the romanticism of that position, though, was just emptied out on the field. And the thing about Clemens, too, was his career got off to a stuttering start. Because he comes up in 84, he's really good. He's young, and he gets hurt, and he looks like he's going to be a guy who, ironically, won't be durable. Actually, we've had a few athletes like that in Boston. I'd say another one is Patrice Bergeron. Starts out, and he's getting hurt, and he has a concussion. You don't know what's going to happen with his career. And Carlton Fisk is maybe the best example. Injury-riddled seasons right after his rookie year. Well, it's actually after his second year in 73, but 74 he's hurt. 75 he's hurt, and he's putting up like these huge numbers when he's in there. So Clemens started that way. So though 86 wasn't certainly his rookie year, that's the only time he was competing fully healthy, taking the ball every turn and starting to do his thing where he was whatever he was at the All-Star break, like 14-2. But he was just like that classic kind of horse. I remember once he was facing Cecil Fielder, and he had painted right on the black, like this 98-mile-per-hour fastball. And the umpire didn't give him the call. And catcher throws the ball back to Clemens, and he caught it barehanded. Like, he just snapped that, and I thought, oh, goodness. Like, it was one of those kind of Mark Messier, like, Gordie Howe, I'm going to put this ball up your bleep and bleep, right? Everyone knew. It wasn't like, it's time for the changeup. Like, everyone knew it was coming, and Cecil Fielder's like, oh, I know what's coming. I'm going to jack this out of here. He blew it right past him. It was just a different kind of, I appreciate that mentality in life, not just on the pitcher's mound.
All right, finally, as we wrap up our meeting with Colin Fleming here this afternoon, Triscuits. I thought this was a death till we part kind of relationship, but is it sort of on again, off again, you and the Triscuit?
It is, and you have something to do with that, too.
Oh, no.
You're kind of like the interloper.
Oh.
You've cuckolded me, Nabisco style, but I'm back. I feel like I'm back because we were talking about Triscuits one day, and I just looked at them as kind of like a light, breezy cracker, and you're like, they're like shingles. They're really heavy, and it got in my head. I'm like, Triscuits, you're making my mouth work really hard here. It is an ordeal. I just used to take you down nice and easy, and now it's like you are work. I like have to cut like into you, like mandible style. And it just, and I don't have a lot of in my life, so this like soured me, ironically, given the salt.
I feel badly about this.
But don't, and when I say salt, for you fellow heart health enthusiasts out there, actually quite low in sodium, the Triscuits, as are potato chips. Other things, that pre-made lasagna and all of that stuff at the Trader Joe's, that is what will give you the heart attack. But you're good with Triscuits. So they were on sale at the CVS a couple weeks ago, and then in the spirit, just how loyal I am to you, of today's show, I got a couple boxes today. They were also, I won't buy them if they're not on sale. So I'm back on the Triscuits. I'm knocking back boxes again, but it's off again, on again. I feel like it could go at any point.
But so, you didn't have a dalliance with Wheat Thins or something like that.
Well, the thing with Triscuits and Wheat Thins is, you might know this if you're also a CVS regular, is that if the one is on sale, the other's on sale.
Right.
So sometimes just to not be a Triscuit glutton. I'll mix and match. But wheat thins are like more, don't you think, of an acquired taste. They're not like as meaty part of the curve as the Triscuit. The wheat thins are like licorice. Like you really have to like wheat thins.
Right.
And another thing, I'm saving lives today, people.
Oh.
If you have black licorice in your home, throw it away. Because black licorice, it will give you a heart attack. That's true. Look it up.
All right. And don't wash it down with wheat thins, certainly.
That's true about the black licorice. And I have, and I also learned something for you today, too. Did you know the Big League Chew is still made?
Yes, I do know that. And I think that came up. We were talking about Jim Boughton. And it was one of his teammates, and now I can't remember the player, but a former Major League player who came up with the idea and said to Boughton, we can make money with this. And, yeah, I guess they did.
Candy cigarettes are also still around. Now, wouldn't you have thought that those things would have gone by the wayside, both candy cigarettes and Big League Chew? It doesn't make any pretense that it's anything but, like, this is like tobacco, but it's bubblegum. So I found that. I looked that up for you today. It's 800 million pouches sold. Which, yeah, but I would have thought they'd be a lot higher. It's been around since 1980. So what that kind of told me is, like, people who have had Big League Chew don't regularly consume Big League Chew. Everyone's had, like, Big League Chew once.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like a one and done.
Is it the gateway to Red Man? I guess that's the question.
You ever see those beautiful, though, Red Man baseball cards from the 1950s? Like some of, they're not tops, obviously. They were made by Red Man. And are we in trouble for saying Red Man? Because that was the name of it, people.
No, that was it. Just reporting the facts. That's all it is. Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown. Of course, you need to go, if you haven't already, to his blog, Many Moments More, and subscribe. Visit the website at ColinFlemingLit.com. Thank you, as always, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.